You are now listening to Talking Transparency, the podcast where trans parents talk transparently. Hosted by Thea Ross, Melissa Lukson, and Cody Connor.
Hey everybody, welcome back. I'm Thea.
I'm Cody.
And on today's episode, we are talking transparently with Dexter Davis. His pronouns are he, him. He's a university student and leader in the trans community in Hampton Roads. He's also the executive director of Men in Transition, and we're going to be talking about coalition building and the role of faith in the trans and queer communities. And we'll be getting their thoughts on organizing and faith in just a second, but first, let's see what's coming up in the community.
All right, well, actually, it seems like we get more and more things coming up in the community as we go and talk with other people, but coming up with the Kalos Coalition, we just had our last TFD, Trans Family Dinner, and it was great. We had a good show out. I know my kids always look forward to it, even if it's just to knock balls around the pool table. They seem to can't wait to do that. But the next one's coming up February 18th. On February 22nd, we have the Love Yourself Card Making Workshop at the Creative Reuse Center. And on February 24th is our second D&D club meeting. Our first D&D club meeting's coming up this weekend.
Yes, but
this episode will come out after that. Yeah. I'm really excited to the D&D club.
I can't wait to roll Math Rocks.
We have all the dice out. I even bought some more dice. We got all our special little bags. And the 26th is the Equality Virginia Lobbying Day. So we're organizing buses to leave from Norfolk, Virginia, going to Richmond, Virginia, so people local to the Hampton Roads area can attend. Lobby days are opportunities to show lawmakers that there are queer and trans Virginians and their allies who will show up when equity is on the line. If you attend, you'll receive an in-depth look at the legislative process in Virginia, information about proposed bills affecting the queer and trans community in Virginia, and you'll get training on key talking points to help guide your conversations with your local representatives and just people in general. And remember, you can sign up for any of those events and get more information by visiting kaloscoalition.com/events.
Perfect. Thanks, Cody. Also, I want to give a shout out to the Southeastern Transgender Resource Center. That's where we'll actually be meeting on the day of, early in the morning. They are obviously leading in this space and continue to lead in this space. And we are very grateful to go with them and other trans-led organizations for the Equality Virginia Day. Also, I want to thank you, Dexter, by the way, for joining us today. So now that we're here, and I wanted to ask you, you've done a lot in the community, more than we could get through in our little short introduction on your CV, but why don't you run down all the different positions and things that you've done a little bit and let us know what you've been doing over the past couple of years?
Thank you. You're right. I probably should have thought about that beforehand. I'm Dexter. I do quite a few things. Right now, I'm actually employed with the Urban League. And so I do EIS, or Early Intervention Services. So I like to pleasantly call it, I am Dog the Bounty Hunter, if you are positive and run away. But essentially, my job is helping connect people and get them linkage to medical care and keep them there. You mentioned the Men in Transition, which is a group that I founded back in October 2019, which is now just essentially a brotherhood of trans masculine folks dedicated to uplifting and guiding each other, and then being present in our communities. I am in school, so I am going to Norfolk State, so I'm at HBCU, which is exciting. I will be starting my position within the next couple of months as their part-time LGBTQ program coordinator, so that will be exciting. And up until then, I am a member of the Norfolk State Spectrum, their LGBT group, as their club president, so we're trying to get things back running. I got inducted into Golden Key last semester, which was very exciting. I happen to be a fraternity member. That about 10 years ago. This is my 10-year anniversary, being a fraternity member of Alpha Omega Kappa Fraternity Incorporated. I have been in a variety of community spaces. So I just realized I do consulting at different colleges. I've done Norfolk State, ODU, Virginia Wesleyan, University of Richmond as well. I've been doing the Transgender Day of Remembrance and Transgender Day of Visibility. I've done speeches at their keynote panel speakers from that them and community since 2019. So it's been quite a bit, quite a bit.
I know it's the sort of thing where if you're doing something in the trans community in Hampton Roads and you don't get up with Dex at a certain point, if you don't run into it, like you've either, just been like not been there, or
you've heard my name.
Are you Virginia? Exactly. And, you know, I know you're absolutely killing it over there at NSU. You are with a, what is 4.0 GPA? Is that what we're saying?
Like, oh, that was the other part. So last semester, because I, you know, it was like a blur. last semester, so I look young, y'all. Don't let them fool you. I am 30, y'all. So I actually...
30 still young.
I am, yeah, yeah. You don't feel it. But check engine light just came on.
Talk to me when you're 40.
Ah! Not rushing. I'm actually kind of excited for that. But yeah, don't so... So at 30, I went back to school. So I was out for about 8 years, got back into school, and that was my first semester. And so I was taking 5 classes virtually, and I was taking a master's level professional course for sex and faith at the Incarnation Institute for Sex and Faith. So I was taking like 6 things all at the same time. And yes, I finished with a 4.0, but I also realized I had enough self-love not to do that again.
I mean, that's pretty impressive. And then on top of that, you've been helping the Kalos Coalition. You joined our events committee. You've been doing, you do so much. Honestly, I worry sometimes if Dex gets a chance to sleep, y'all. But sometimes. Beyond NSU, beyond your activism and the projects that are going on the next couple of years and things, what does the future hold for Dex Davis?
The future holds bringing every one of my dreams to fruition. William Hollis is a motivational speaker. And one thing he said was, you know, when you found what you're good at doing, when it's easy to you and difficult to others, right? And so it's one of those things that I realized that speaking, communicating, I went to NASTAD. It's a conference for Southern community-based organizations, or CBOs. And the year I went last year was my first time going. And they asked me the similar question. And I said, you know, I would say I'm an intellectual empath. And now it's turned into, I'm an intellectual, I use intellectual, empathetic storytelling to intentionally curate and create spaces. And so going forward, I use my lived experiences to intentionally create those spaces. I know for some viewers that, or listeners that may not know, my chosen mother recently joined God in Heaven recently, and it has kind of reignited my purpose. And what I realize is that we're here for a purposeful time, not a long time always. And so with that time, I realized that I was charged with making great art. When I graduated from Salem, our teacher said, make great art. And I've kept that with me. And so I realized that my activism, my advocacy is in art, in sharing stories, in connecting individuals, and in taking the pain that I've experienced and turning it into pressure, then turning it into a product, then turning it into prestige. So with the pain that I'm going through now with this grief, I am committed to creating spaces where we learn about life insurance and how that can actually change the tide of the wealth inequality gap, where we learn about how to receive love, not just give love as a person, as a people pleaser, how to receive love, because that's a very active process. And more importantly, one of the things I'm working on is a guild, a place where art isn't just a vehicle for discipline and for growth and progress, but a place for healing. People here, there's so much great art here, but you don't have a lot of places to show it, but let alone people to cultivate and nourish those skills. So I used to think it was on me to do all these things, but that's, I don't have to do that. My skill is finding these beautiful people, finding the places and spaces and connecting them and saying, hey, we got the schools, we got the skills, we got the tools, we got the people. Let's make some movement. So I want to be and continue to be a catalyst for change and a lesson in love.
That is amazing. I love that so much. I mean, if it sounds to me, I don't want to like reduce what you said because that was so beautiful to like organizing and planting seed and growing. And that's honestly, you don't want to put a cap on that, you know?
Give yourself a place to grow and place and space to, you know, my dad calls it discover. He doesn't refer to my transition as a transition. He says, there's only 2 transitions you make in your life, when you come here and when you leave. He says, but you've discovered yourself. You saw someone and you're revealing that. And then I get to discover you alongside of you. And as a person that's been out of your life for 22 years, that's a very special gift that you're giving me, is the opportunity for me to be along your self-discovery journey.
Well, I mean, I think that's an incredibly important way to really look at it, because you know, we use the word transition, you know, and a lot of the words we use, we don't really use for ourselves. I don't think people always acknowledge that, right? We use these words and we use these labels so we can try to help other people understand us. And because you're not really transitioning, you're just becoming more you and more you and more you. You know, this transitioning, and I think a lot of parents attach to that word sometimes, and that's part of that. Oh, my child's becoming somebody else. No, your child's still your child. Your child's becoming more them. That's what's happening, and so that's great. I'm happy for you that your father understands that. You know, I a lot of parents, even parents that really love and want or trying to understand what's going on with their child, struggle to grasp that.
And mind you, it's not going like it was easy. Like, it's definitely, it was a work in progress. He's in his almost 70s now. But again, that not being there and then realizing when I finally met him, that's a whole crazy story that we can get into. But when I finally did talk to him, I said to him, it was about 3 or 4 conversations in, I was like, I do this for a living. Like, I help people reconnect with their families, and it's usually messy. I said, but one thing I had to realize is if I'm going to help people do this, I have to be willing to do the same. And so I had to put it in my mind, number one, I'm willing to fight for your love. And I don't even know you. But number two, and more importantly, when we finally meet, if you can't look at me and see you, then I'll leave you alone. And for him, coming back to his faith, as he says it, I was a heathen. Now I became a believer. Now I'm a knower. Now, after the few years we've been together, I'm a knower now. But when I met you, I was a heathen becoming a believer, meaning I was walking into, he wasn't always religious and not even really spiritual. And so for him, it was, how do I reconcile this, who this person is, you coming to me, my Christian faith, all of these things? And as my grandfather, before he had passed, had put it to him, he was like, don't be arrogant enough to think that you can mess up one of God's creatures. You tried that. But understand that you asked, you prayed to God and asked for your child. And God brought it back to you. What are you going to do with this gift? And when, as a person that's been hurt by church a lot, that's been hurt by faith, that's been hurt by these systems, when he said that you coming to me was the manifestation of Jesus Christ's grace, in real time, I had to step back and be like, what in the world are you talking about, old man? Because as my mom expressed it, she said, it is a grief. And one of my brothers, his name is Michael, he's trans, but he also has kids that are trans. And when he explained it, he said, you know, when my kids came out to me, it was a grieving period, but not for the same reason. It was, I had to let go of who I thought they were going to be. Regardless of their gender, I realized, I've watched you, and these are, you know, kids that he married into, but they're his kids, right? He said, wow, after seeing y'all, living with you, I thought you would be one way, or who you might become. And so now I'm discovering, wow, you're not that person, and I'm learning more about you. And again, it's a discovery, not a grieving process, but he said it wasn't just about their gender. So when I relate it back to my dad and him trying to understand me, my grandfather, all these things trying to put it together, when he had to put it like, I was out of your life, I made some horrible decisions. I'm not going to say mistakes, decisions that affected everyone, not just you, but everyone involved with you. He said, look at it like this. Love is feeling, but love is action. It's what you do. It's how you show up. You have 22 years of evidence to say I didn't love you. I have feelings for love for you, but I wasn't there. I didn't do the work. I didn't show up. You had every piece of factual evidence that said, I don't love you. So why did you reach out to me? And I said, there was this thing, this inner child in me that just, I took a leap of faith, let's say a faith of a mustard seed. I might have had that of a whole watermelon, but hey, right? And he said, this is the thing. You reached out to me and you said, essentially, parabolically, right? You came to me and said, Father. There's a specific story to Jesus where which Jesus comes to the man and he's like, imagine I'm sitting on this. You come to me, you put me on a throne, you kneel next to me and you say, Father, you give me that title of Father. And he says, I don't deserve it. I did all these things. I don't deserve. And you just look at me and you say, Father. And and I messed up and I wasn't here. And the more I get to know you, you are a spitting image of me and all these things. And I just say, Father. He said, what I didn't realize was that I was guilty for all the decisions that I made and how they affected you. And because I couldn't let that go, I missed a relationship with you because I didn't have grace. And he said, so one of the biggest conversations that he had, which in this case with him, through Jesus was, in this case was, if I forgive you of your sins, why are you still holding on to them? You just missed 22 years of this life. This person has just come to tell you, I told him, I forgive you. I forgive you, and I give you an opportunity. And when he put it to me like that, he says, you showed me what grace was, real grace, because I didn't deserve it. I still don't deserve it. That changed how I interacted with people. It changed how I show up. It changed how I engage with folks, even to this day, where I was like, you know, up until now, I've been told that our experience, who we are, is just fundamentally wrong. Or fundamentally bad, or fundamentally perverse, and all of these things. And my father said, no, you are the essence of what God meant when he meant love is action and love is what showed up. You showed up no matter what and said, I'm gonna give you this chance. And you gave me an opportunity to love in your authenticity.
Well, and it's interesting that you hit on a couple things there that are really interesting and good points. You know, one, going back to what you just said about our existence, you know, you always getting that feedback that your existence as a trans man is perverse, is invisible. Yeah. Invisible or perverse. And your father doesn't see that. And he shares a lot of the same beliefs as the people that you said do. Right. And it really does just show, and this is kind of the way I look at it, too, because I myself, I'm not a really religious person. I've been very religious. And I'm very, very familiar with the teachings of Jesus and the Bible and all of those things. But to me, I boil it, you know, if I have a God, it's love. And a lot of the way we love, whether we're religious or not, is based on our kind of understanding and our interpretation of God or how we're loved, our relationship with love. Right. And you look at a lot of the ways some Christians are taught and believe. And what we see, and I've said this before, it's one of the things I just like to say now, I guess, and that is all violence, whether it's physical or emotional, is an expression of self-hate. Right. And what you see is very much, you can see places in the teachings where you can interpret all people as their existence being perverse, as it being born in sin, right? And so I think you have a lot of people that, especially when they don't have that real understanding and relationship with love in an honest, sincere way, that they internalize that for themselves. They internalize that they're perverse, that they're not really worthy of love, that they're not really, you know, worthy of those things. They're just lucky that somebody forgives them for their perverse horribleness. And they internalize that, and that's how they feel about themselves. And then they externalize that when they run into something that represents, you know, that and that's, and to them, in a lot of ways, that's part of their salvation. That's part of what cleanses them of being perverse, evil creatures. And so that's a, you know, a big thing that I run into a lot, because we do very much in our community, and I say our community, because, you know, my daughter is a member of the community. My friends, my family are the member of the community. And I also very much myself, as I go through this experience, very much connect to the idea of not being defined.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I think is really important. And one of the things I wanted to make sure was carried across in the Kalos Coalition. And what we're talking about here is becoming, you know, how we become who we're going to be. And then also, you know, that process externally, as that's like a revealing where that was concealed when we were always who we were and we're always becoming who we are. But from the outside, we're being revealed, or we were earlier concealed. I think that a lot of people conceal themselves as a consequence of trying to adhere to certain doctrines. Or they try to do, and they expect other people to conceal themselves, or they expect that from, and that sort of, you know, is in itself a type of oppression. And the other thing I'd like to say is that every revealing is itself a type of concealing. When we talk about this, you know, coming out, or talking about a transition versus a becoming, I think that, you know, when you reveal who you truly are, that conceals the image that they had in their head of it, and they have to grieve that image.
That's a good point that you make, because it brings up, I've always told people, authenticity and imposter syndrome are two sides of the same coin, because there are some times where you feel, when you are trying, you ever tell you fake it till you make it when it comes to being happy? If you do it enough, eventually it becomes second nature. But up until then, you feel like you're phony. You feel like a fake. I know when I first come out, I said, oh my goodness, these people are seeing me a certain way. They are. This is cool. To the point of imagination. My dad says, what's the root word of imagination? Image. Thinking about it, the reality is we see images in our head. Communication is an attempt to communicate what I'm seeing in my head to someone else. What's the most frustrating time of your life? Being a child, being a baby, because no one understands you. And it's like, this is the best way he painted. Imagine that you are a soul, a spirit, with complete and total knowledge, autonomy, everything. And then you come into this new existence with no language, no movement, and you are completely dependent on everybody else around you for your entire survival, until you get to a place where then you can kind of advocate for yourself. And that takes a long time.
If people can understand you.
If you can even understand what you're trying to say.
If you understand yourself.
Right? Which is, again, terrifying, because I'm trying to convey this image in my head to someone else. Dr. Julian Kevon Glover out of VCU, she says, language is an approximation at best. And I think we forget that when we use all these terms. What I'm trying to do is explain, I'm a wordsmith. The most frustrating thing is when I cannot find the right words to explain how I'm feeling. We all long to connect. So when you don't have...
If one day I can just say the word tree and a tree would just come out of my mouth and you get it, it would be amazing.
You know?
It would just be really cool.
No, and I'm...
That's literal too.
I'm the same way. I'm a wordsmith. And I very much, to me, the meaning of words are very important. And using the right word is very important, because we use the wrong words all of the time. We attach the wrong meanings to words all of the time. I mean, we attach, like respect. One of the biggest reasons why so many people think respect is something that's earned. And you'll have a lot of people tell you that. No, you have to earn my respect. Respect is something that's earned. But if you ask them, hey, if you're walking through a grocery store, and somebody who's never met you before, with which you've never had an opportunity to earn respect with, you interact with them, should they or should they not treat you with respect? They will say, oh, well, they should treat me with respect. Well, why? How have you earned that respect? Because respect's not something that's actually earned. Everybody gets respect, or should. That's something everybody should get, is respect and love. Those aren't earned. But because we attach things like the word admiration to respect, now admiration's earned. Right. And we attach admiration to respect. A lot of times we say, I respect somebody. And what we mean is, I admire them.
Or I fear them.
Or I fear them.
Because connotation to words are very. Yes. But also words like language and ideas, they fluctuate. Back in the early, I don't want to date myself and then people be mad. But a little over more than 100 years ago, the words homosexual and heterosexual were clinical definitions to express someone with an unhealthy desire in these sexual attractions. You didn't want to be labeled a heterosexual. It meant that you had a sex addiction, essentially. And then over time, these words change. But like you said, the heart meaning is, what am I trying to express or convey to this other person? Do they understand it? And sometimes when we're using language and words, we weaponize against concepts, not realizing, again, the impact that some of these bills having. If I take one word out, there's a whole slew of other things that are attached to a concept that we're not really talking or addressing.
And we let ourselves get trapped by our understanding of words too, like happy. Like happy, you talked about you know, when you're not happy, you fake it till you make it. Well, I mean, what most people don't realize is a lot of times when you're just showing happy, you are just faking it. Because when people say, I just want to be happy, that's not a true statement. Nobody just really wants to be happy. That's not life. It's not even a reality, right? And even in our greatest parts of life, none of them are preceded by happy. And some of them don't even just contain happy. Even in the victory or triumph of them, they still have pain and stuff mixed in with that happiness, absolutely. What we're often saying when we say that is because we're not saying we don't want challenges, right? Because nobody really means that. We're not saying we just want life to be easy all the time because that's not living in reality. What we're saying is we want emotional strength and stability. We want to be able to go through these things without it wrecking us. We want to be able to feel confident in our emotions as we move through. That's what we're really saying, and that's not happy. That's being able to deal with fear and anger and disappointment confidently and in a healthy relationship.
But how much of that is just trying to avoid pain and seeking pleasure too, you know? And I don't mean to get to like psychological urges and those sorts of things, because I think, you know, we associate certain words, certain concepts with pain or other things, and with the absence of it or with pleasure and those sorts of things. And I think that those become bigger than themselves. And for me, beyond all the specific things, because the word that I can say happy to you, and that conjures a specific emotion and a feeling in your body, specific memories, sense, like specific experiences that are unique unto your lived experience. And, you know, I just want to understand. So when we talk about communication and we talk about the need for communication, especially in the relationship to transition, I want people to understand what my euphoria is and what my dysphoria is. But there is not enough language to communicate that. And, you know, I want people to understand that, but I also want to understand their euphoria and their dysphoria. I want to because the more that I can understand, the more that I can empathize, and the more dynamic the world around me becomes. And I want to, you know, it's funny, we talk about language and not understanding. Like you were talking, you said the word heathen. Like when you first met your father, you thought he was a heathen. I was like, oh wow, so you got your pronouns almost right out there. He them. Because like, you know, but it took me a second, but that's just the way that language is, and we're always processing. And if you acknowledge that process and that filter, then you acknowledge the imperfection of language. And if you give grace, to come back around, it's all about grace to other folks, and really work on that understanding, then we can move past disagreements and misunderstandings. Which brings me to the other topic I wanted to bring up with you tonight, which was coalition building. Mm-hmm. And how, as an organization and as a community and within the organizations you've worked with, how have you seen coalition building work, and how have you seen it fail, and what is the future, you know, for Dex Davis and coalition leading?
Right. Funny enough, that's actually one of those workshops we were talking about at NASDAQ, mm-hmm. At their CBO summit. So currently, my goal with the Urban League is to continue coalition building. One thing in particular we are trying to do is get all of the different nonprofits in our service sector that specifically are working with these marginalized communities, Black and Brown and LGBTQ, all of us come to the table. And by World's AIDS Day, we're able to do something that showcased that. To me, coalition building isn't just amongst agencies. Like, my ultimate goal is to get the pageant people involved, because we have a theme for the year. And I'm like, guys, they're marketers. That's what they do. So we have services. Why not work together? They can promote our services to people who need them, and we provide them a space and platform to do what they're already doing and great at that they go out of state for, right? We have amazing leaders in our communities that are hosting spaces, for example, in the arts. Beautiful example of coalition building. I have worked at a variety of different agencies. One of the agencies, called ETSI Health Clinic, hosted a ball a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. It's their COVID-19 ball. And I had just gotten the Trans Justice Fund grant funding. And most people do direct services. But our lives, as my friends say, our lives are always on fire. We need something different, right? Life's still going to be on fire.
Trans joy is potent, but continue.
Okay. Sorry. But let me tell you about some trans joy. So I paid for 12 of us to go to the ball. I took 12 of us to go out to the ball. And if anybody's been seeing us on Facebook, the pictures of Lex with all these trans men, that was our first ball. This is where they became her mother. This is where she gained a group of sons who we are now the Peanuts. This is why we show up to a bunch of places. It started at a ball. And not only did it start with a ball with just ETSI, which then turned into other things, off of a whim, I reached out to Coco to say, we need to do a trans ball. Let me really tell you something about coalition. When you can plan a ball, a trans ball, this first thing done here in Virginia in about 6 weeks. All the different agencies have shown up, supported, promoted, have had people come out, have tabled, have gotten members, bought tables, not just families. I'm talking big nonprofits down to folks who said, and the same 10 guys that went, one of the gentlemen who walked the ball, his name is Ken. He has an Instagram called Pharmaceuticals Now. He just won an award for Pharmacist of the Year.
Oh, yes. Ken O'Shea. Yes. He's on our board.
And the suit that he wore to the ball, he wore in his interview for his thing, the first suit he ever made. That is the impact of coalition building, right? Like, here we are. I got people who did things and are like, oh, my goodness, I didn't know I could do this. Beautiful thing, for example, coalition building is realizing what is your strengths. What are my weaknesses and how can we work together? Realistically, we all working for the same kind of funding, the same demographic, the same people. But what you guys do, Mass has a syringe needle exchange program. I got people who need needles now. I'm going to send them to Mass. No questions asked. You live on the peninsula and you need testing. I'm going to send them to Mass. No questions asked. Maybe you're living in Norfolk and you say, it's not as effective for me. Let me send you to the Life Center. I need some resources now. Let me send you to CAN. Mm-hmm. And being at Urban League helps because we're not in the same LGBT circuit, so we're able to bring people together. EVMS, they're able to say, we're a hub because we do all the things. Y'all come here. What do you need? Coalition building is taking the time to say, we are not supposed to do this. We all know vision statements are supposed to be larger than life. That's because they're supposed to take all hands. It takes a village. So it's realizing that if I want to help the people that I can best help, where are my strengths? And where are your strengths? Iron sharpens iron. So what is it that we can all do? And then where are your weaknesses? Because if you fall, I got you. Now, it does tend to, unfortunately, not go so well because things like capitalism. There is a scarcity model. And we've been taught that we have to compete for funding. We have to compete for people. We have to compete for people's attention because we're going up against social media accounts trying to compete for your same bit of attention. That is where the competition is one part and so is hurt. Back to the concern is when you've been hurt, and goodness forbid you've been hurt by other community members, it builds, it grows. You reached out for help. Someone couldn't help you, so you created your own. But now that hurt is still there. And we tend to want to bring people and say, well, let's air out our grievances and move it forward. And back to what my dad says, he says, apologizing and accountability are two different things. Apologize is me saying, I'm sorry for what I did. Accountability is me realizing, regardless of my intention, my decision had an impact on you. Regardless, I may not even know what it is. So I got to ask you what it did if I don't understand it. And I got to acknowledge that you're having an experience. Now we can move forward with some boundaries. Okay, all right, I did this. Maybe we slighted you. Okay, this is how it made you feel, like you can't trust me in the relationship. Understood. What needs to happen next to do that? And then also the biggest thing that maybe people want to hear it is you have to see people as they are. The biggest thing about love is realizing, as they say, if I know that my loved one has a substance use problem, not going to keep substances around. If I know that you're a thief, not going to keep my wallet out. That's love sometimes. Love might be, I realize that you might be a hothead. I realize that certain things might stimulate, I don't want to say trigger, but stimulate you. I now know I may need to put someone next to you that's going to better co-regulate you. As a leader, that's what I'm looking for. When I'm thinking of these partnerships, sometimes it's not about the big picture. It's I know that this person has a great strength. However, their weakness is their temper. Let me find somebody that does not faze them at all. It does not faze them. So this way, they can build that relationship and have that co-regulation and eventually have that ability to trust. When it comes to respect, people say, again, respect is earned, right? Treat people the way you want to be treated. One thing I learned from my mother, Miss Alexis Walker, was you treat people better than they treat you. You respect them more than they respect you. Because how she showed up, she was a lesson in love. I'd asked this the question that came up, how do we build coalitions when we're hurt? She was a lesson in love. She said, I see people for who they are. But I also realize, and this is something I've kept with me, is I like to think of us as we're all a piece of God having a simultaneous experience. So I have to realize that if there's one creator somewhere out here, that they're feeling every single thing all of us are feeling simultaneously. And that makes me stop and realize that there are other people having an experience too. Mm-hmm. And so part of that coalition building is realizing that, yes, your vision and mission is important, but so is the other person's. Mm-hmm. And it's not, doesn't have to be a threat. That is a tactic used to distract us. That is a tactic used to keep you from accomplishing the things that you are called to do. So it's also realizing, again, I got to be receptive of that critical feedback the same way I have to be receptive of love. Because the same as me being scared of feedback is also me being afraid to receive the love that I feel is deserved.
I can't, that is, that's such a great synopsis about the actual like challenges that you have to do. And what I'm sitting here listening, I feel like the big thing that I come to it, because, you know, we started the Kalos Coalition. Coalition's right in the name. You know, we're trying to build, and we come into these spaces where some of these different organizations have existed, and I've felt the pressure. I've felt the pressure and competition. Oh no, there's enough. But my theory, my logic, and I think it holds up and I think it holds weight, is that more hands and more pools of money bringing more resources to bear for our community can never be a bad thing. And the question then becomes, how do we find ways to buttress up against it? How do we handshake? How do we, if we overlap with intention. How do we not do the work twice? How do we make resources more efficient for our community? And that's just building more infrastructure the way I see it. I also think that when we talk about how do we overcome these egos, it's ego. Let me talk about, that's yep. The big word here is ego. Because, you know, and this really is more specific in the nonprofit sector, and coalition building, as you rightly said, goes beyond nonprofit sectors because ego and competition kind of feed. And you'd like to think that in nonprofits, you don't have as much competition and we can be more collaboration. But even beyond nonprofits, we'd hope there could be more collaboration and less competition. But if we do have competition, that it be healthy competition that spurs us on, and we find opportunities amidst those competitions to put shine on other people. And one of the things my father, he raised me, and, you know, he's 75 years old. I love you to death, Dad, if you're listening, is that, you know, we don't judge people by their worst day. We do not judge people by the worst period in their lives. People contain multitudes. And I know this contradicts what you said earlier, but life is long until it's not.
Yeah, and, you know, life is too short and too long to be unhappy.
There you go. And if we don't set aside our ego and we don't extend grace, and whether it be through your own understanding of forgiveness and religion, whether it be through your understanding of how you move in the world, where you step and how your body is, that concept of grace, giving it, is the first step to receiving it. And if, you know, if I had to add anything to what you said, because you honestly, there's no need to add anything to what Dex said, we talk about coalition building, but I think it really is for me the focus on that grace, you know, trying to like put my ego aside and just dance as most beautifully as I can, you know, try not to step on people's toes.
Grace. My dad said, look up the definition. It also can mean eloquent movement.
Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the things that I really dislike, and it's there in all, you know, as we talk about, whether it's nonprofit, whether it's for profit, we all, you know, grew up here in America. And so we're all taught to use the word competition a lot.
Yeah.
Competition a lot. Competition's progress. We're competing for resources. Uh-huh. But if we were all just gathering resources and pooling them, it'd be the same thing. We wouldn't be in competition. Uh-huh. A big part of it is just letting go of that. We've been taught to attach our value to how we perform in competition. And it is. And basically, we've been taught to attach our value to how we look next to others and not to who we actually are. And so a big part of that is just, you know, slowly helping people learn that lesson.
In addition to that, I will say the one thing that is different in nonprofit, in my experience, than a for-profit is that, okay, let's be real. I like to make money. So MIT is not a nonprofit. And I've made that very clear because I have the ability to make money with the guys if that's what we choose to do. That understanding is, we understand it's business. We know if a big business is on shenanigans, we're not surprised. It's business. It's what you do. Nonprofit industrial organizational complex exploits the passion that people have. People will always tell, and there's one thing that does kind of get in my heart that does hurt me a little bit. Yes, you should be passionate about the work you do. However, as a former manager and have learned a variety of unsavory techniques, if you're passionate about what you do, you're going to work for free. You're going to take work home from you. You're going to, it's because it's good for the cause. And what you're not going to realize is that you're running a rat race. What you're not going to realize is that the data and the determinants that we draw are all arbitrary. So the reality is you're chasing an exponential goal. It's literally, don't ask.
You started making somebody more money, just not you.
Exactly. But on top of that, I have to speak, again, as a Black trans person, as people at the intersection of these equities, this is the first time that some of these people have been able to break out of poverty. So again, that competition directly affects their way of life. So there is an ego comportion, but there is very much so by tying it into people's way of life. Now you've upped the stakes. And people say, yeah, I got to if I let my ego go, but what happens to my kids? What happens to my family? What happens to the financial legacy, the financial security? I've heard this story plenty of times from a lot of nonprofit CEOs. I was homeless. I didn't have any money. I was poor. I was the demographic, and now I'm here. And same thing, even us making enough of an income that you just kind of get by, there's an expectation that, well, you shouldn't be a nonprofit if it's not passionate, it's not about the money. No, I still got to survive. But we use that to fuel this idea that this should be an emotional experience, even though we're treating it very much like it's a business. Reporting is very business. Somebody's going to get their money. My dad taught me, he said, that money, when you get it from funders, is not y'all's. That money in a business, it's the businesses, then it's profit. But in a nonprofit, it is always to the community members.
100%, because if you have a 501c3 and you close or you have some sort of issue, every dime that you have is a public fund. It goes to other 501c's and is redistributed. And one of the things that I wanted to add on here as I was listening is you said that, you know, the minute transition is a 501c5, 4?
Right now it's just LLC.
LLC. But
yeah, in the beginning stages.
The wonderful thing about 501c3s, and I did not know this until I had taken a workshop that was hosted by Black Brands here in Hampton Roads, the Black Chamber of Commerce. And so we took multiple classes, and they were talking about, and there was a nice gentleman. He has a great, I'm going to forget the name of his nonprofit, can't give him a plug right now, but he goes around, he cuts lawns for elderly folks out in Portsmouth and Norfolk. And it's a wonderful program that he's doing for free at first, but he actually set up a separate LLC because you know, he got good press. People wanted to pay him to do things. Different people in the community were interested in hiring him, like the cities and different things. But and it was a lot of additional administrative expense, all those things. Come to turn out, and this is true, this was confirmed by experts there, and you can look it up yourself if you don't believe me, nonprofits can in fact engage in for-profit business. The difference is that in your accounting, you need to account for it separately than you would do donations and other things. And then you pay taxes because the IRS will not, because you just pay your for-profit business. You pay. So under that entity, you can still do for-profit work. And I think that one of the things that comes down to nonprofit work for me is about innovation. A lot of folks that are on the other side, quote unquote, they have the benefit of Ivy League educations. They have consultants, people they can hire. They have all these different things and resources to back it up. So they're able to use and manipulate these codes in different ways. And the education and access is something to that education. And then also the practice and being able to, that's something that takes time. And it takes, you know, and I'm very grateful to the Chambers of Commerce, specifically Black Brands, specifically what Volunteer Hampton Roads is another organization that I've taken tons of workshops with to learn these standards, norms, the actual laws and differentiations, because there are a lot of misconceptions. And if we move past those, we can open up new avenues, new innovative solutions, and bring more resources to bear. And that's what I'm all about. It. Bring
it
more
is.
Resources
it
to bear.
Is. Ooh, I felt the passion. I love it. I learned something new.
Well, and for me, you know, one of the things that I get the most out of everything that everybody else is doing, you know, obviously those are things that'll benefit my child later in life and all of that, but they're not, you know, resources that I'm necessarily going to use, but the coalition and the events and connecting all of those together, it helps people experience each other. You know, we were talking about words and meaning of words. And things like that earlier, experiences and experiencing each other transcends that.
Yep.
In so many ways. I mean, as a parent of a trans child, I can read so many words and I can have people give me all the different verbiage and talk to me all these different ways. And I can tell you from experience that is nothing the same nor anywhere close to as educational as it has been for me to experience other trans people and trans members of the community and other families and that experience has taught me way more than anybody being able to speak to me in certain words and give me certain verbiages and definitions ever would.
Yeah, that's one thing I came into when I was doing one-on-one kind of counseling with when I was working at my last job was there's a level of explanation that I can give you, but it's almost like classes, like you kind of just go through it. And it's a process. And again, talking to people, they think that you can give them all the answers. And I'm like, I can tell you a lot, but you have to live it. And the other part is that trans issues still are everyone's issues. They're just not used to how it's framed. So, for example, when we're talking about certain reproductive issues, if it's up in the trans community, there's probably another whole side of it that people aren't thinking. And the reality is that our problems are reflections of cisgendered issues.
Absolutely.
And I think people don't tend to really see that all the time because they're like, oh, the bathroom issues, or oh, these women's concerns, what is a woman and what's a man, and these other things. And as I'm talking to parents, which blows my mind, because I remember being at a place where parents didn't reach out, you know, like you just kind of, you let it go and just hope that they figured it out. You know, parents are calling agencies now trying to figure out how they can help their children. You know, they're like, I don't understand. And the number one question that I'm having with parents who are like, my child is going through this, what do you recommend is? And I'm like, ask them what kind of experience they're trying to seek. Because I realize the uncomfortable conversation that you are not ready to have is your understanding and concept of gender. Because what the children are telling you is, I'm a little boy, but I get kitchen playset requests for boys now. We didn't used to get that for Christmas things. Now it's more boys are requesting this, right? But there's a time where some guys will say, I'm dealing with young boys in particular, where they say, I want to do this. And I'm like, ask the question to find out what they're really saying. Is it that they want to be a girl, or is it that they are trying to experience something and they're trying to communicate that to you? Because now you have to look back and say, what makes you think that your child is trans? What makes you think that they're not trans? I had to teach a cisgendered therapist how to determine if someone should get a trans letter or not. And that's when I had to realize I have to explain to you at what point is a person able, because he's an effeminate man, his name's Steven, he's great, he used to work at the center, but now he does writer's block therapy. And I said, you're a feminine presenting man, what we call in community as a butch queen, right? I said, but what you have to now figure out as a therapist on the outside of this, that they were doing this well before you got here, because that's how many of us got our letters, right? What's the difference between you and your feminine expression and your feminine energy expression and a trans woman? Because there is a difference. There's a line at some point that you, as the medical professional, have to have enough conversations to discern. And I'm trying, that was my struggle, was I can't tell it to you. I have to work with you with clients to figure it out.
Does a line exist?
And that's where...
Is it existential, really?
Is it?
Because I feel like the bright line for me is not objective. You cannot define this with measures and metrics. The bright line is defined by self-autonomy, self-definition. It's who you believe you are, who you feel you are. Because if you can be the most effeminate man in the world, you can be a butch, and you walk. But at the end of the day, if someone calls you a girl and it strikes you wrong in your heart and it messes up your stride, your grace, your movement in life, the way in which you feel about yourself, then that's not right. And these are things that are internal and resonant, and people want them to be external.
Because we also remember we came down from a medical industrial complex. Mm-hmm. Listening to Charlie Burton, he wrote Black Trans Boy in the South. Great book. He's in his 60s. I met Xander, another mentor who lives in Florida, and he's in his 50s, I want to say. Their definition of being trans isn't like mine. And when I talk to the newer generation, theirs is identity-based. When I asked these two elders, I said, what happened? Why did you transition? Both of them told me that when they were younger, they were masculine for quite a bit of time. But they got a lot of violence. And there came a point where, after very vicious attacks that both of them experienced, there became a pleasantry and they became men and were able to move without violence. And eventually the socialization of the movement, it adjusted, and they realized that this was not the same as being a masculine woman. They was actually like totally different. And it connected and resonated with them. But at the time it was about safety. When I started transitioning, I started my experience in 2013. When I was at Ithaca, New York, I was one of the first groups of people to pilot the informed consent program there. So I didn't have to have a letter. But when someone brought the words to me, I said, oh, wow, this expresses how I express myself. At that time, most people were either just trans masculine or trans feminine. We didn't have a really non-binary presence. So I get to watch the evolution of, again, this understanding of gender, but realizing we have all these different experiences of transness happening. But when I did it, this is when the medical complex shifted. It used to be you had to get a medical diagnosis in order to get something so an insurance company would pay for it. So when I listen to the old guard, that's where they say, this is how we got things paid for. And then again, this new question is people want to know, who's paying for this transition? Is it public funding? Is the public paying? Now again, who pays for it? Who gets for these things? There's a capitalism. One thing I will say is that I love that people have access. But I am cautioning people that if you go, make sure that you have a person that works with you, because some of these doctors don't care. You're another client, which means they're going to upsell you on surgeries and things because they get an insurance kickback. I've seen that, unfortunately, which is whatever. I tell people, you don't have to have surgeries if that is not your vision. Don't let somebody force you into a lived experience you don't have to have, but don't have that expectation you have to, because there are narratives from the same complex industry that regulated what it meant to be trans, because at one point it was a mental health disorder. Then it didn't become
in our lives, in my life. Yes. It was very different prior to 2009. It was very different prior to 1996. But, you know, one thing I want to push back on a little bit is this idea that non-binary identities are new. One of the things that I feel like is very, you know, it's not highlighted as much, is that, and even here in American history, there are figures, historical figures, who, you know, bear out the existence of non-binary identities, such as the public universal friend. They're born in 1750. And after experiencing an illness in 1776, they claim to have died and then be reborn as a genderless evangelist for the Quaker faith. And, you know, I could go into more specifics about it, but when we talk about Quakers, especially historically in the context of their political activism and their the influence that the public universal friend had is a lot greater than a lot of people would give, because they actually showed up to these conventions and spoke out and built a community. When you think about building a community out in the woods in 1750, the people that you had there were on board with what you believed and who you were and what you said. So I know that non-binary, agender fluid individuals have existed, and non-gendered, even genders I can't even conceptualize, that go beyond this have existed for a long time. And I think that the language, and come back to this, is what's changing. And then also the accessibility and the visibility. And then I'd also say that populations, I mean, we talk about these things like they're, you know, percentages, or, you know, if you have 8 billion people, you're going to have more agender and trans people. And this is going to increase. It's just the way of the modern society and the way things go. And
our understanding of gender and our roles in it change and are changing in so many ways. I mean, even, you know, as a cisgendered man, cisgendered het man, given, you know, close proximity, you know, to the community and all of that for quite a long time, even before my child came out. But I've started realizing, and it's becoming more accepting for me in all of the circles that I move in, for things that were very much, when I was younger, they would not have been acceptable as a boy, certainly not above a certain age. And I've never in my life thought to myself, oh, I'm not a boy or anything like that, and nothing along those lines. But that doesn't mean there's been many times in my life where I have wanted to do, been attracted to, associated, connected with what would very much be expressed as feminine things. I had a very close relationship with my grandmother. I admired her very much. I remember at a very young age, when I was younger, I would walk around in her heels because they were hers and because I really looked up to her. Yeah, it wasn't something that I even associated with being male or female. It was something that I associated with my grandmother, who I loved and admired very much. I really enjoyed Care Bears, and I really enjoyed My Little Pony.
Yes, Bernie.
I mean, I did. I very much enjoyed them and their messages. And I watched Spider-Man 2, and I watched Rainbow Bright and Strawberry Shortcake and Pippi Longstockings, and I connected with all of those on various levels. But some of them were okay for me to connect with, and some of them, especially as I got older, were less and less okay. No. Well, those aren't boys' toys. No, that's a girl thing. No, that's a girl color. And what I think people don't realize happens to you is that happens to men and women across the board, is we get these little bits of guilt and shame. And even self-hate attached to that. Because I didn't stop liking pink. I didn't stop liking unicorns. I didn't stop liking the Care Bear stare, a giant ray of energy, of caring and love. I didn't stop liking that.
I just started hating myself for liking it and just started suppressing that part of myself. And every time I saw it and was like, oh, I like that, you should hate yourself for that. You should feel bad for that. And it just
builds.
And I like that because the way that you just described Care Bears is literally how people see trans people, because we represent in a physical form those things that they don't have, they feel they don't have access to. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it may not. Again, I come from some, there's a part in Black culture where some people will tell you, I will beat you before I give the universe a chance to beat you. So there is sometimes a very, again, fear of threat of violence to avoid violence. That is also where that narrative comes from, where you're scared, but you see this person that's doing the things, like that one person that's like, I don't care, and I love Care Bears. And you're like, I can't stand him, and maybe he don't know, because he's doing the thing that you want to do. And I'm glad that you're able to express that in such a way that for some people, they could probably understand and connect and be like, wow, I didn't think about it like that.
Well, I mean, and that, well, that was a big part of me and my journey as a father. Long before my child came out, was knowing that I wanted my children to be themselves. I wanted them to feel confident and comfortable being themselves. I wanted to go after what they loved. I wanted them not to be ashamed of the things that they loved. To not have all of those blocks. And it was really hard, because I immediately upon expressing that to myself, I want my children to have that. I'm too intelligent of a person to have not immediately understood that they have to see that then. Right? And they have to see that from somebody that they admire. They have to see that from you. They have to see that from me. And so I have to be able to then go and do all of these things that I have taught and reinforced in myself time and time again to not do.
Confront that shame.
Right? Mm-hmm. And not just that, but put myself back in a situation that previously represented be rejection.
Mm-hmm. Take me back to that inner kid's place. That's one thing I love about having friends with parents is the way how before you respond, is this, if you were sitting here with your kid right now, is this how you would want them to feel? Because that's what my dad says. It's like, it's not about the issue. It's that I don't like this feeling. I don't mm-hmm. like you feeling like this. So this is what we're going to work on. You know?
And I feel like that's a good place for us to really ruminate on as we move on to the next section, because we're running a little long on time here. But, you know, I want to give a shout out to the Care Bears. Watch the go yes, check out the Care Bears. Let the loving and the kindness shine through. Our next segment, we have a little palate cleanser for you. We actually we run a program at the Chaos Coalition called the Trans Wishlist Program. And we have a story that was recently posted after we were able to fulfill a trans wish for one of our local transips. So I wanted to share that with you, with all of our listeners. So here we are. This is a quote from the book. And again, just to be clear, our trans wish list, we do anonymously. So we're not going to give our names or things like that. We're just going to tell the story so we can talk about the experience. What they said was, I have been struggling to break free of a financial conservatorship. This legal but unjust stranglehold is the only thing that keeps me in contact with my transphobic family members. As a result, I have not been able to use my own money freely and safely. This is especially true when it comes to affirming my identity with my personal style. Thea Ross and the rest of the Chaos Coalition found a workaround, though. Miss Thea sent me an e-gift card so I could get clothes that better fit my gender. I got two shirts at Box Lunch, both with Mulan theme. I'm not going to say I always knew, but that movie was definitely my queer awakening. Also, I got my first compression top, basically a binder with breathing room. This was huge for me, as I've been wearing multiple sports bras trying to support and compress my chest. Finally, I got a rainbow mosaic print button-up from one of Target's Pride collections and a dark blue tank top from Walmart. With many of these items, I plan to put together a gender-neutral take on Milan's pink dress. Miss Thea also got me in contact with a non-binary hairstylist, Liz, uses they-them pronouns. Liz gave me an epic cut in color for free. I'm autistic in addition to being gender fluid, so the appointment had more than a few info dumps. I can definitely recommend them. And that would be Lunar Sanctum hair, by the way. In short, finding my own style and help really saved my life. And it is my sincerest hope and prayer that other trans siblings can and will experience the same joy. Thank you. And honestly, when I got this this wish list that came in through this application, it was a condition that I had not even considered. Uh-huh. My lived experience does not intersect with having those sorts of labels and that intersection of oppression and marginalization, of being disabled or being classified in a certain way, to be under a conservatorship. But if you think about that, you know, this is a young adult. This is not a youth. This is someone who is well into their 20s, lives on their own. you know, high functioning autism. Like, I hate to use that term. Let me take that back. I apologize for using that term. That's a terrible term. But the type of person who does not need someone, you know, being in a conservatorship, they don't need this in any way, shape, or form, and that they're actually able to exert that control. So as we run this program, we continue to learn more about the needs of our community and also their wants and dreams and goals. And if we continue to do these sorts of things and reach out, and if you're listening to this and you're trans, and if you apply to our TransWest program, sometimes we might not be able to fulfill it, but you do educate us. You do give us a means to advocate on your behalf anonymously and securely so that we can go out and secure more resources for our community. So if you'd like to, go to kaylascoalition.com/programs. You can click on our link there for our Trans Wishlist program. You can apply, or you can even read some of the publicly posted, anonymously posted wishes, and you can give support directly to those folks who we're trying to help today. But anyways, that's our little palate cleanser. We wanted to tell you some happy things that are going on and work that we're doing in the coalition. I think after this, we've got our new segment coming up next, Cody.
Yeah, to the news, which means we'll be missing Melissa today.
I know. I feel like when we don't have Miss Melissa, it's like, are we going to do the news? Are we going to do politics at the same level? Because she is so plugged into everything in the local politics. And I think tonight she's actually up in Richmond,
That's what she's doing tonight. She's up in Richmond, plugging away local politics, actually. I think she's working on the Virginia Beach 10-1 voting system.
Oh, that's very big. Yes, that was very contentious, right?
Very contentious. I mean, I don't understand why it was so contentious. It makes a whole lot of sense that the people that live in the district would be the people that voted for the representative.
That would seem logical, but it also resulted in the Republican or conservative takeover of the school boards, because I know that they implemented the voting districts in Virginia Beach. What is it, the last school board election where it was that they had that sort of system, the 10-1 system, where they had whereas before, you know, anyone in the city could vote for any other school board candidate if they were up, versus now you can only vote for the one in your district. And what this actually enabled was, you know, I live back in the Little Neck portion of Virginia Beach, and it's a very conservative area. And same thing with like Great Neck and those areas where you have larger houses, older families, you have a lot of white folks, a lot of people who have assets and resources, and are maybe leaning towards a more conservative worldview in general. These folks, they put in people that were, well, like David Culpepper, who, you know, not to admonish him in any way, but he was formerly, a Navy JAG officer at Guantanamo Bay during the Bush administration from 2006 to 2008. So, you know, right around those times that those human rights violations were being confirmed. So how does that guy get on the school board other than you don't have the votes and opinions of people elsewhere in Virginia Beach to actually counteract that extremely conservative thing? So, you know, that cuts both ways. I could argue, you know, direct representation, more direct representation, you know, having more access is better. But then at the same time, when we think about a city like Virginia Beach, 450,000 people in this little town here on the edge of the coast, if y'all don't know. Well, I don't know. I think I might want to have a say about some of these people. Well, you know, what do you think, Cody?
Well, I mean, you know, I do see what you're saying, but I think one of the places where not having this 10-1 cuts real deep in a lot of ways is with our BIPOC communities, especially because, you know, being that still, unfortunately, in our society, we do have, you know, people don't want to talk about it, but we do have very segregated neighborhoods. We do.
But that's de facto. Not de jure. We didn't like put it by law. We're going to segregate people by, you know.
Well, not anymore, but look at when those neighborhoods started.
They are all still connected. That's true. At the end of the day,
those neighborhoods didn't. Weren't built in 2020. Those neighborhoods were built in, you know, most of them in the 50s and 60s before the Civil Rights Act and before desegregation in schools.
And there's still political redlining.
And they very much exist still in those same boundaries. And they've also still very much been perpetuated within those boundaries with political redlining and the way that they've built districts and those sorts of things. So because of that segregation, which still segregation in our communities, which also still creates segregation in our schools. But because of that, they've been able to use that to completely cut BIPOC communities out of having representation at all in our government by having these citywide voting scenarios. And so it does give certain communities the ability to, really control the fate of a specific seat. And I see that's one disadvantage, but I think the really big and valuable trade-off that we get is we actually are able to get representation and significant representation in places where there was absolutely none before. I don't want to say absolutely none, but where it was much more difficult to get that representation for those areas. Because that's the other thing you see in some of these, when everybody in the area is able to vote for the representative that represents that community, especially when you go to places like city council. I mean, I can understand what you're talking about, how it does have an impact on the school board. I do think some of that impact is an oscillation coming off of the 2020 mask thing and some of that.
That's fair. That's a fair assessment. Doesn't it also come down to who draws the districts? I mean,
who draws the districts?
Well, that's the other part of it. But if you don't put in a 10-1 voting system, then you don't give yourself, because you can always redraw districts, right? You can redraw districts, you can create new district maps, and you can even redraw and create new district maps by law based off of making sure that there is enough representation through race. That's in laws. There's.
I mean, that's definitely a certain approach. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that the Supreme Court would. Yeah, I guess what I was about to say. The Supreme Court are going to fight us on this because they obviously want a very political system, and I want to find the one that gets us most open to make sure that we have the most representation. And what do you think, Dex? Do you think like a 10-1? I mean, I know Virginia Beach is in your...
Just define again the 10-1 thing again for some of us who don't have children.
So the 10-1, basically what the 10-1 is referring to like your city council seats and your board seats.
We've got like 10 districts in the city.
Yeah, and so you'd have 10... Mm-hmm. Seats that are voted by their district. They represent each district specifically.
And then one at large.
And then one at large, which like in the city council, you would have, so 10 different councilmen or council people, council members.
We just talked about that.
Yeah. 10 different council members that each represent their own specific
district
in the city. And then like the mayor, the at large council member. And so that would be the 10-1. Like I said, that's, the people in the district are able to vote and decide on which councilman represents their district. As Athea points out, that does give, the ability for some conservative members that we wouldn't necessarily want, at least us personally. Obviously, a lot of people in that district wanted them. Mm-hmm. Gives them some opportunities and gives us less the ability to kind of thwart their cause. But then at the same time, we do have sections of our community, and you see this in a lot of communities, where their representation doesn't get decided for them. They don't end up with a representative very often that represents them. Mm-hmm. Their representation gets decided by the rest of the city, and their rep usually is representing the rest of the city.
Yeah. Thing about, because it sounds very, it's the voting and again the awareness. Because when Thea mentioned the two areas you mentioned, Little Creek and Great Neck, I used to work out there. You're right. If I'm an affluent person, what do I do when I go home at night? I go home at night. I sleep. I probably work a 9-to-5 job, or I may work longer hours, but I do have access to be at these kind of meetings and do these types of things. When we talk about BIPOC communities, some of these parents who are necessary for voting don't have the time or the access or even the knowledge. I'll be honest with you. Been to a few of these different events and still haven't heard from that from most. That doesn't come up in, with some of the BIPOC parents. I don't even see that when they talk about their representation, you don't hear about that as much. So I think if anything, it's making sure that in these communities that there is a concerted effort to showing the community where their power with schooling lies. Because one thing I'm hearing from a lot of parents is that they are very overwhelmed. And this is, I'll tell you, politics, I can debate very well, but there's just so many nuances on top of people's emotions. It's a lot. So imagine you're taking care of children. The school stuff is constantly changing. It's very sensationalized. So there's also this all this information. You're trying to make adjustments, and then I have a political basis on top of that, which some people don't even want to get into. And in many BIPOC communities, I hear the first thing is, well, what about us? Because it seems like we want to use Black people for certain things, but not for the issues that may be at hand. But I think it, again, comes down to how do we create a way to provide education to these parents in such a way that they can make an informed decision as to what works best for those districts. Because again, most of the time, these people are tired. And if they're tired, they're not engaged in the system. If they're not engaged in the system, those who have access to the system will engage in the system. And then the answer is going to be, well, you just come out here and vote. Just do what you do, your research. You learn. This is where I'm saying there's different systemic things that are at play. If these, we still worry about kids who cannot, parents who cannot afford to give their kids money for school lunch. So in their mind, well, you know, if you vote for the person, they still got to help their kids with homework that they don't even understand. Many of them are just trying to keep a roof over their head, and they don't have access to the political. I am just not getting to a place in my life of getting out of drowning that I can breathe a little bit. And I realize that in some cases, politics is only accessible to certain folks if they're just trying to survive. I was not really worried about a lot of politics things because I was just trying to make ends meet. Now I'm in a place where I feel like I have the privilege. It feels like it's a privilege to talk about politics and how this affects me because you're in the thick of it. So when I hear things like, I haven't seen it on news, I haven't seen it in my phone, and I'm like, maybe it's just the algorithm. But that also then goes back to play. Like, if I don't see this, I work, my job has an education department. They don't even talk about that. Why? Because they're trying to get kids tutors. They're trying to make sure we had a student shot. A college student recently went to a party off campus and was shot. They're worried about those things, but not realizing that this has a whole other effect. So I think it's also when from a war analysis, it feels like you're being attacked from so many sides that you leave this entire flank available, which the legislative part is very important and representation is really important, but it feels like you don't even see that.
And how much of that do you think is by design?
Well, I mean, that was going to be that was going to be exactly my question.
Design and just
all heck a lot
bad
of
bad management.
Well, design and bad management, because you look at certain things. Now, I've lived in a lot of different states in our country, and one of the things that I noticed, you know, I lived in Oregon for a while, Portland, Oregon for a while, and one of the things I noticed in moving to other states. That's really significant that, you know, difference here in Virginia is so in Portland, every registered voter gets a book mailed to them. And in that book is everything you can vote for, every person and everything, both sides, pros, cons. This is the argument for them. This is the argument against them. This is what they support. This is what they don't. Everybody gets it. And it comes with your voting thing, all of that.
I like that.
And so that's one of the things I think, and I think in a way this is intentional, right? Is we are given all these overwhelming and sensationalized things, and we're not given things in a way where we connect that having this information and voting for this person is going to be what could help us pay that rent, mm-hmm. is going to be what gets our kids school lunch.
Is what's going to keep us from being criminalized just existing in public. And I hate to segue, but Utah just became the first state actually to advance anti-trans legislation this year within their House of Representatives that approves one of the most extreme bathroom bills. It actually defines sex across state law in a way that excludes trans people entirely. It defines a male as a person assigned male at birth and female assigned female at birth. And it criminalizes people who use the bathroom in publicly owned buildings. And if it passes, any trans person who uses a bathroom which aligns with their true gender could be charged with voyeurism or criminal trespass up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine. So when we talk about, you know, the costs and the mm-hmm. battle that we're in, it seems like we forced to handle too much, flanks are open, and we're having to walk through a field of landmines. And that's the situation I think that a lot of people at the top, political powerhouses, economic powerhouses, elites, want average folk and working class folk mm-hmm. To have to constantly struggle with, and that And why? Because it serves them. It allows them to do things like take away elections and put in policies that give them tax benefits. It always goes
back to class. We all know it goes back to class. We're just not supposed to say that.
Well, I mean, it does and it doesn't. I mean, it intersects in class and through race politics and mm-hmm. also through gendered politics and the way in which, you know, patriarchy wants to control certain types of resources and keep them out. So to me, you know, we could just call classic white supremacy. Let's just call it what it is. But it is like if we don't stand up against these things in these granular mm-hmm. ways, and I feel it. I feel it. You know, I can see like the liberal, like, oh, shame, shame. Like, oh, go, just go out there, do your research, you know, all sort of stuff.
That's hard.
But what are the ways you think we can do better? Like, what? Like, let me ask you this.
Coalition building. I saw that segment.
This man.
Coalition building. Because I know politics. I tell people, politics is not, I could get a good debate, but that's not what I like to spend my late night hours doing. So what I like to do is find the people who are passionate about it. Find the people who got seeds. The ones that are like, oh, I kind of like this. And then you just bring it out and they're obsessed. Because again, there are people who that's where their calling is. And I can do things that are on the ground, that are boots on the ground that work for me. I know that there are certain places and spaces that I'm just not strong enough in that I'm not. Why sharpen that? That's someone else who's passionate about that.
Oh, don't talk yourself down here. Because
if I talk myself up, y'all going to think I do other things. No. I don't want anything else more than what I do.
Policymakers up here, you okay. know, when they start thinking, they need to be informed by the lived experiences of people doing work
right.
that understand these flanks, understand. So my question to you isn't so much of the expectation. Oh, you've got the right policy. Here it is. This is what you got to do. But I do think that the insight and discussion brings out and elucidates these things. Like what Cody was saying that yep. they do out in Oregon and things that we can do that are more like that. But what were you saying? Sorry.
No, kind of like me and you, for example. I know that I'm a disarming speaker. So I read well. So I say intellectually empathetic is that I'm able to read a situation and feel empathy, but I process it in a very logical way. So my responses come off as very calculated for me. So some people are like, oh, it's just manipulation because you're a Libra. No, I'm very calculated. That's just my skill. I can take a story from someone that's very passionate, put it in front of the right person, and be that bridge, because sometimes you're going to discount that person because of who they are, what they look like, where they come from. You won't even give them a chance to hear their story. So when you have people like us who can say, you don't need to hear my story, but I do know what you need. At the end of the day, you know how you get these people to work with you? Money's, friend. When we did the ball, a fun fact behind the ball, the business partner, there was another business partner, his name is Terry McGriff, and this is how he had to explain it to me, because I didn't understand the importance of where the ball came from, the trans ball. It's not just about community experience, it's great, but the understanding is that what we do is tourism. What we do is called undocumented dollars, meaning that there's a group of people that have a financial investment in a civilization or a community. They need our money. We go to work. We pay taxes. You need my money because I have to reinvest in the system. When we don't, the system crashes and we're already facing inflation. You actually need our money. And so what he was explaining was, he says, what you have to see is, for example, we get funding from nonprofit stuff, but the cities of tourism will work with you. Because when you have an event, you're bringing people, you're bringing economic impact. Someone asks, well, what's my ROI? What's my return on investment? Someone says, oh my gosh, you're dehumanizing. Yeah, but in a business element, sometimes you got to hit them in their pockets, which is, if you're going to do this, let's be real. Do you know how much money you have to spend to prosecute these trans folks? Do you know how much money you have to spend to police this? Do you know how much money you have to spend in potential lawsuits if someone says, well, you came in here and you saw this, and how do you even prove this? There's a financial investment in this in some capacity. I still need a story that needs to be told because we're human. But then that human story also has to match with the, y'all realize that we have these events. This is the economic impact. This is the negative economic impact that's going to happen because this law is going to unintentionally affect these people. What about fathers? Oh man, I feel so bad for fathers stressing trying to take their daughters into the bathroom because they're like, and there's not always a family. There's, as a trans person, I can tell you, usually not a family restroom somewhere. And y'all don't think about the fact that with, for example, bathrooms, if a cis man has to go into a stall, he probably gonna take a little bit longer. But why do you think it's okay to put 4 urinals, only one or two stalls, and these men have to wait? I went to the airport coming back from Dallas and from Norfolk, and we had to wait in a line for a stall. And these are older gentlemen with different things, because the expectation is, well, you're a man, you should just be able to stand to pee. Doesn't matter what they're going in there for. You've made this expectation and made it difficult, where I've seen men be uncomfortable, but in some cases at events, women can run to the men's bathroom just to use it because the stalls, these simple things that again have a financial impact. They have a community impact, not just in person. There's more to that. So being able to take those pieces and put them together.
And I think that you're focusing on the negative side of the coin that I try to focus on all the same time. Not in a bad way, but the cost, the negative, mm-hmm. which I mean by negative, okay? I try to focus, especially at the Kalos Coalition, one of the pitches that I really feel like we need to be making to these chambers of commerce, mm-hmm. to the cities, to these different individuals and business investors, because we talk about resources, innovating resources, solutions, is we have to say, you know, look at the economic boon. Mm-hmm. And we have models that we can point to. Look at the tourism industry in Florida as a consequence of what Ron DeSantis has done over this past year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's all sorts of propaganda lies that they put out. But when you actually look at the numbers, because you cannot fake those dollars, okay, mm-hmm. at and a certain point.
They're going to be wondering where their money's at.
And these are the arguments that are going to get your center right, your center left people who are not necessarily embroiled or invested or even mildly interested aside from the utility of a culture war. Yep. And you buttress that. You follow it up with that negative. And by the way, if we don't, here's the cost if we yep. go this other way. So, and then it becomes an overwhelming, not just cultural and social enrichment argument, but that economic argument, that tier that it becomes like, oh, okay. This is real.
And just like we say, it's a biopsychosocial economic impact in how a person, it's the same thing. You have great storytellers, you have great artists, but you also have the parents who are saying, I'm raising the next generation of people, and what I will not allow you to do is just like you're saying that this is a mindset you're putting in, you will not teach my children this type of rhetoric or hatred. There's plenty of transparency to say, I don't stand for this, because at the end of the day, as a grown adult, like Cody just mentioned, I had to unlearn a bunch of misogyny to have access to a better relationship with my children. Trans people just are a physical representation of us reminding you that there are people who have to do the same thing just because of these social systems. So the best part of the coalition building is realizing, like you said, we all have a strength and you never know where it comes from. And when it comes to political lobbying, some people say, oh, I just can't get into politics, so that's not my strong suit. But you being passionate, you never know that your passion may stimulate someone who says, you know what? I got it. Or this is the right place for me, because they again, whether it's the making sure there's lobbies, writing the bills, feeling like they can do the education necessary to run for these positions. Many of our community members don't feel that they have the qualifications or the experience. So now we can put them into positions to do that. And I keep looking toward the future. Yes, we have to deal with today. We also are building for tomorrow. So there are people that one day you're going to take this. So let me get you prepared, because in all honesty, history doesn't, I mean, it repeats itself. So the different issues change, but in your time, it's going to be something different. How are you going to lead in leadership? How are you going to lead with love, but also make sure you protect the people that you serve? We're building the future leaders by being the future leaders, by modeling to them, especially in these hard times, what it looks like not to give up. That civil rights had to happen with MLK and Malcolm X. It was two different versions of very different things. Black Panthers, they were all necessary to get that. The financial, when COVID hit, I'd be black parents. I said, you know what you really should do? I ain't gonna hold you. The American school system is the biggest experiment on children since it came out, right? This is an opportunity for y'all. We got plenty of parents, black parents who are teachers and have been for 30 years who are out of work. Open up them churches, take them kids to them churches, and why don't you educate them kids? We can go back, just like the Black Panthers did full school. We bring, now you have churches in community areas where kids ain't got to go as far. Parents who were former teachers, they can teach them. There's different ways that you can do that. But the moment you do that and you take these kids out of that economic model, now it's going to be an issue. Now we're going to see, wait a minute, oh no, there's a whole big effect. So I think when we talk about, again, there's a social element, but that economic element and finding out who are your economic champions, who are your power players, who are your political power players, who are your social power players, who blends between the two? Maybe you're just an artistic one. Ain't nothing wrong with that. That's beautiful. That's the best since entertainment, right? But I'm glad that you wrap this in with the fact that there's an economic component. And sometimes you have to speak someone's language. Like we said, language. And some language is money.
Yeah. Well, and also teaching, you know, being leaders and teaching the new leaders some of the evolution. Uh-huh. Right, because that's where
you don't know your history.
You know, that economic model. Because right now our economic model, very much we're either focusing on economic development. That's what you'd hear that a city council, we're have an economic development plan, or we have, or we're focusing on helping people. Uh-huh. Right. And those are two different focuses. But there's very little realization they don't have to be. You know, like when we talk about, I was actually talking with a city councilman about this recently. you know, one of the reasons why they don't want to invest in affordable housing is because they're on an economic growth model.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But they don't understand the connection between affordable housing and economic growth. Right. You don't understand the connection between when you invest in your people.
Uh-huh.
Right. Your people reinvest and grow your economy. Right. You put affordable housing in a neighborhood. You can still put businesses there. And guess what happens when you put affordable housing there and people move into that housing? Guess where I spend my money? I live in Virginia Beach. I don't spend my money, most of it in Norfolk. I don't drive to Norfolk to go grocery shopping. Uh-huh. I don't even drive to the other side of Virginia Beach to go grocery shopping.
That part.
You know what I mean? I drive to the grocery store like 3 blocks away from my house, and my money stays in my neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Economic growth. But we have that disconnect. We feel like we're either growing the economy or we're helping people. We don't understand that when done correctly, helping people grows the economy.
Also, growing the economy helps some people, and an emphasis on some, very minimal some people. But I feel like this has been an amazing discussion. I've really appreciated you coming on, Dex. We're going to have you come back on the podcast because there's so much to talk about.
We can do 400 or 500 more hours of this, I'm sure.
Before we wrap it up, can we go over our events coming up in this next week, a couple weeks, one more time? I think... I'll do it. I'm prepared.
Right, let's go. Right, let's go.
Well, I got to memorize. Let me just go off the top of my head.
Okay, here you go. Let's test your memory.
With the 18th being the next trans family dinner.
That's correct.
Say it with your chest.
And
say it confidently.
And the 24th being the next D&D.
This is true. You missed one in the middle, though.
Oh. I missed one in the middle.
That's right, because the 22nd, we have your Love Yourself
Heart Making Work. Oh, this is the 22nd, Love Yourself. And then the 26th is Lobby Days.
That's correct. And I just want to give a shout out also to the Creative Reuse Center, the 757 Creative Reuse Center. That's where we'll be hosting the card making workshop as well as our D&D club meetings. And that's located in MacArthur Mall right there in Norfolk, in downtown Norfolk, centrally. And
if you're a crafter, you want to make anything.
If you're going to the mall and you got kids that just need to touch everything. Or you have partners that need to touch everything. I'm, you know, possibly speaking about myself, just drop them off there. It's free babysitting, and they'll be crafty and leave you with a gift. I'm just saying, you should definitely check it out.
And one more thing before we sign off, is there any way or anything that you'd like to plug or that we can support in the world of Dexter Davis today?
This will be a little easier. Okay. So stay tuned. My job is having join week in the first week of February. So definitely stay tuned. I will post information with Kalos Coalition, so you all will see that. And as far as me for Dexter Davis, stay tuned. I will have some podcasts here launching. I'm committing to the next 30 days. So within the month of February, the first one will be Microwave Sex and Meal Prep. And you have to turn into the first episode to know why it is titled that. So
I will be tuning in. You better believe, okay?
You know, so definitely check that out. And if you're looking for a speaker, if you're looking for an MC, if you're looking for a motivational speaker, I'm accepting bookings at dexter-davis.com.
You heard that. That's dexter/davis.com. Did I get it right?
Dash with a dash. You know, dash, like Mrs. Dash. Dash. dexter-davis.com.
There we go. I don't want to mess up. Thank you so much, Dex, for coming here. And as we always say, trans joy defeats hate.
Ew.
Every time.
And always, every day.
And we're out.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Collective Tattoo and the Kalos Coalition. We are listener supported, so if you like the show, please consider donating to us on Patreon at patreon.com/talkingtransparency. Like, share, and subscribe across social media, and be sure to visit our Linktree at linktree.com/talkingtrans.